All right, we're ready to get started. Does it sound okay? I want to start off by saying we're so thankful and honored that you have come to keep the Sabbath with us, and not only keep the Sabbath, but to be here with us today for our teaching Seder for Passover. We've done this now for the last 10 years, and we hope it'll be a blessing to you. We hope that you come and you'll learn something about the gospel of Jesus Christ or Yeshua HaMashiach. The Passover is about the gospel, the true gospel, the gospel that Paul preached. And this is probably, as far as I'm concerned, one of the most important services you will ever be in your life. Now, we're going to take a little time today to teach so you'll understand Passover. We've been doing this 10 years, and I've done it many, many places over the course of these last 10 years, and a lot of times we leave and people know how to go through the ceremonial Seder, but they don't understand Passover. And I think it's very necessary that we understand Passover. Passover and Passover season is a very intense time for the people of God who knows the Scriptures. You see, it's at the season of Passover when that thing that Yeshua told his disciples in Matthew chapter 24, he said, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, he said, those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Now, what he's talking about and in reference to is the great tribulation begins. One day, I don't know when that day will be, the great tribulation will start. Now, I'm not talking about the 7 years of Jacob's trouble. I'm not talking about what most people have in their mind of 7 years of tribulation. There is 7 years of tribulation. It's called Jacob's trouble, but there's only 3.5 years of what's called the Great Tribulation. It's that place that Yeshua describes as being worse than it ever has been on the earth or ever will be. It's going to be a horrible time. It will begin at a Passover. Now, the reason I'm saying that is we know from the Scriptures. Now, let me say up front, no man can know the day or the hour. So I'm not trying to set dates, okay? But he says you will know when it's near, even at the door. We know that whichever year it is, whatever day that happens to come on, whatever hour that happens to take place, when he returns will be Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles. That's the first thing we're going to do as believers. Jews, Christians alike, the first thing they're going to do is keep the Feast of Tabernacles according to Zechariah chapter 14. So if it's at a tabernacles when it returns, and I go backwards 3.5 years, I'm at Passover. You understand the reasoning behind this? That's when it's going to take place. I'm not telling you a day or an hour, but we're in a very, very intense time of the year. Now, a lot of people say, well, there's no use to worry this year. They don't have an altar up. See, an altar has to go back up. It has to. And many people say, well, that'll take a long time to happen. There is a group in Israel today called the Temple Mount Faithful who has already the cornerstone and all the stones prepared to build the altar back. They are waiting for an okay to go up on the Temple Mount and put that altar up. It will go up, and it will be used, and the world will go nuts, and they'll say that's an abomination to God. And yet, that's exactly the thing that God tells us is going to happen. It will be shut down. It will be stopped. That's what the first part of the abomination of desolation is. They will shut it down and replace there, or put beside there on the Temple Mount, a statue. A winged statue from what Scripture really tells us. Read Daniel chapter 9. You'll see what I'm saying is scriptural. And I wish I had the time to show you all these things, but for the sake of time and for us to get through this Seder, we need to understand how important this really is. Like I said, they're ready to put it up. The Temple Mount Faithful has practiced and practiced and practiced this, and they say, they declare to the world, as soon as they get the okay, the cornerstone for the altar can be set and will be set in 20 minutes. That's a sobering thought, isn't it? What if it's this year? I'm not saying it is. I don't think it is. Next year? Not so sure about it. I want you, if you would, this evening, I'm going to read from my Bible, but I want Everybody look at the screen up here, because you may not have your Bibles with you. I want to look at the book of James, chapter number 4, before we get into this about Passover, and try to explain something to you and get the right concept in our minds before we can really understand it. Now, we can do it. We could go through the Seder. I could almost do that blindfolded. I can take you through the ceremony. But you could leave here and not understand it. I don't want you to leave and not understand it. And I don't want to offend your religious sensibilities at all. I'm not here to offend anybody. It did happen from time to time. I don't mean for it to. But I think this is such an important time in the history of the world that we be very, very straightforward. Notice with me in James chapter 4, beginning in verse 13. Very familiar story. If you've been in church much in your life, you'll remember this story. James here says, "Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit. Yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You're just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that. But as it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil." Now, don't you notice verse 17 very carefully? "Therefore, to one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it's sin." Many people don't understand Passover, Jew and Christian alike. They do not understand the biblical idea of Passover. We've got an Easter mentality. Easter is one day, right? That's our mentality. It's one day. So therefore, we think that this Wednesday, beginning at sundown, Passover will take place on the 14th of Nisan, actually the 15th at sundown, and that one day is Passover. It's not. We'll look at these scriptures in a minute in Leviticus chapter 23, but Passover, Pesach in Hebrew, is actually 50 days long. It's a whole season, okay? It goes from Passover all the way to Pentecost. Now, you need to understand these things. Like I say, I want you to understand them before you leave here today. I think it's that important. Several reasons I want to do that. Every year, I struggle with what to say. Everywhere I go, I struggle on how to say it. There's some places I go that I can't be too blunt. You know, I've got to watch out for certain things. When I go into the prisons, I have to be very careful. Messianics has already been kicked out, and I don't claim to be messianic. I claim to be one that follows the scriptures. There's always that possibility of being kicked out of the prison system and not being able to go in there and share with the inmates on a weekly basis or a bi-weekly basis or whatever, and so I have to be very careful. But today, we're in my house. And so I get to tell the whole story. Now, again, I'm not trying to be arrogant about it. I'm not trying to offend anybody. I'm just simply here to tell you the truth. You might have in your mind, just like in verse 13 of James here, of chapter 4, James says these people, you know, they've just made up in their mind and in their heart that they're going to go to this city and they're going to spend a year there and they're going to do some business and they're going to make a profit. It's already made up in their mind. They've already decided what it is and they've already... But James says, you ought not do that. You could be wrong, couldn't you? What if it come to a matter as important as the death, burial, and resurrection of Yeshua? Don't you think about that for just a second. How important is that? Can I ask you a question? Is Easter about the death, burial, and resurrection, or is it about the resurrection? What's it about? The resurrection, right? We celebrate it. I was taught to celebrate Easter because it's about the resurrection of Jesus. Taught that all my life. Passover is about the death, burial, and resurrection. We're here for a teaching Passover. We're not here to do Passover. You can't do Passover until the time comes, and that's Wednesday night, and you do it in your home. You do it with other people coming together in your homes. But we want to teach you how to do it, and we've got these little booklets that's in front of you there called the Haggadah or the Telling. That's a gift to you. We want you to take those home, learn how to use them, learn how to do Passover. You're not going to understand everything about it, but the more you do it, the more you're going to understand on how to show people the gospel of Jesus Christ, okay? Jolene, go with me to 1 Corinthians chapter number 15, and I want to make my point here, and I'm not trying to be dogmatic, and I'll show you what I'm talking about. This is the Apostle Paul, and in verse 1, Paul says, "Now, I make known to you, brethren, the gospel which I preached to you, which also you received, in which you also stand, by which also you are saved, if you hold fast the word which I preached to you, unless you believe and have believed in vain." Listen carefully, verse 3. "For I delivered to you as first importance what I also received, that Messiah died for our sins according to the Scriptures." Did Yeshua die on Easter Sunday? He died on Wednesday, didn't he? Now, I know what the Roman Catholic Church teaches, and most people, you know, go along with that, and they just take it for granted that he died on Friday and he rose on Sunday. Einstein with an IBM computer can't keep it in there 3 days and three nights. Can't happen. Not trying to be ugly about it, just stating a fact. So the death, look what he goes on to say in verse 4, "and that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures." Paul says that's the gospel. And so when you teach Passover and you go through this Seder that we're going to teach you how to do, you're actually teaching people the gospel of Jesus Christ that started 3,500 years ago, not 2,000 years ago. It's that important. It's so important that we need to be very plain about it, but still at the same time be very loving. I don't want to offend nobody. I don't want to make you feel like you're inferior or that I'm trying to say that, you know, you don't know something. Sometimes, you know, you just have to say things real plain. You know, plain talk's easy understood. Now, Paul in this same chapter goes on to say that he said, "I am what I am by the grace of God." And I think that's the way we ought to be, don't you? I am a hillbilly by the grace of God. That's the way he made me. Okay, I'm not apologizing for that. I'm really not, you know, because that's... And I know some people get offended at my speech. I've had people from up north, you know, they'd have a big laugh and, you know, talk about the accent and how they can't understand it. Well, I can't help that. I am what I am by the grace of God. But, you know, sometimes you have to just do what you're capable of doing. Now, I'm not capable, first of all, of using high and lofty words to impress you. Now, I could don my tallit that I have up here with the zitzits on it, and I could put on my kippah, and I could look very Jewish. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. But that's not going to convince you that Passover is what you're supposed to do, right? Because you're not going to understand it. A very famous painting of the Sermon on the Mount, some of you may have saw that before, and it's an artist's rendition of the Sermon on the Mount. There Yeshua is, and there's this great crowd of people around that's painted there. And in the picture, there's a little boy. And he's watching a butterfly. He's not interested in what Yeshua has to say. And, you know, he's got his eye on this butterfly, which naturally, you know, kids do things like that. There's nothing wrong with that. But the problem is one of the disciples is watching the child watch the butterfly. So I would a whole lot rather you know what and understand Passover than you had to understand the Jewish garments. Because, folks, just to be honest with you, the tallit with the zitzits was a commandment that was given no less than 2 years after Passover was established. Think about it. The kippah, from what I understand, from all the things that I could ever study, did not begin to take place until about the 12th century. So it's not the outward things I'm trying to get you to see. I'm trying to get you to see what it means. Now, it's very important because Passover is this important. It's what starts the Great Tribulation. Now, there's another reason, as I already stated, I'm not capable of trying to use high and lofty words. I'm not against people that are able to do that. I'm just not, so I'm not going to try to fake you out and be something that I'm not, okay? Let me illustrate it this way to get you to understand what I'm saying. In your mind, go with me back to 1963. I'm a 12-year-old boy. It's in July. It's hot. Me and my dad goes into the pine thicket about 100 yards from where my son lives today in a housing development, and we're cutting pulpwood. I've got a home light 770D. When it's got gas and oil in it, weighs 32 pounds. I'm 12 years old, and we're cutting pulpwood as hard as we can go. We load that stuff by hand, about 4-cord on a 56 GMC 2-ton truck. We haul out about 10 miles, and we unload that pulpwood onto a flat car. And then we go up to Frank Perkins' store about a half a mile from there, and we stop and get gas for the chainsaw and oil for the chainsaw and gas for the truck. And we go back to the woods, and we do it all over again. And while we're on the way, we'll take an egg biscuit out that's been wrapped in cellophane paper or wax paper, and that's lunch. That's just the way things were in 1963. But while we're at the store, I'm 12 years old, and you know how 12-year-old kids are. I'm hot, I'm sweaty, nasty, I stink. I've worked hard all that morning, I'm going to work hard all that evening. And I come up to my father. Now, please don't take this wrong. I'm not trying to be offensive. Honestly, I've heard people pray prayers that were so eloquent and used such high and lofty words that I have to peep and see if they had wings. You know, it sounded that good. And I'm not against people that does that, but I'm not capable of that. When I pray, when I talk to God, I pretty much just talk to Him like I talk to you. And it gets results. It's kind of like with my dad when we stopped at the store there. If I went up to my father and said, "Oh, great Father, master and controller of all of our household, could I beseech thee for 1/10 of a dollar that I might purchase for myself a cold carbonated beverage that might quench my thirst?" What do you think my daddy had done to me? No, I go and say, "Daddy, can I have a dime to buy me a dope?" See, I'm a hillbilly. And so I just say things real plain, and he understood. Okay? So that's what I'm going to do with Passover today. I'm just going to be real plain about it. Now, to do Passover, that means I've got to make a decision. Do I do Passover? Do I do Easter? Do I do both? Which is right? Which is wrong? And does it make any difference? Does it really make any difference as long as we do what's in our heart? Well, I want to remind you of the book of Jeremiah chapter 17, verse 9. Jeremiah 17, 9 says this, "The heart is desperately wicked and deceitful above all things. Who can know it?" Now, you may think you know your heart. These folks in James chapter 4 thought they knew their heart. They would go to a certain city. They would do business there for a year, and they would make a profit. But they were wrong, weren't they? Listen to the news this week. There was this little old thing going on about a mega million dollar jackpot. Anybody hear anything about that? Yeah, I know you did. And it was $640 million. Do you realize when they were talking to people on the news and asking them, "If you win the lottery, what are you going to do?" Here's what I heard. People declared, "When I win, I'm going to send my daughter to college." Didn't say if I was going to win. Said when I win. She already had it made up in her mind. She was going to win and she was going to send her daughter to college. Grand idea. But she didn't win. Other man said, "I'm going to pay off all my bills." Did you know in order to have a $640 million jackpot, according to the lottery rules, they had to sell 1.3 billion lottery tickets? Only one person got it. Don't even know who that is yet, but only one person got it. But everybody thought this right. I thought, man, I've got the right number. They just happen to be wrong. That's kind of the way Passover is. It's kind of the way this decision is. Now, I said all that to take you to Deuteronomy chapter number 12. The book of Deuteronomy chapter number 12. Let me start in verse 28, Jolene. "Children of Israel were saved in the land of Egypt by a Passover lamb. Remember? They were taken from there to Mount Sinai, and there they was given the Torah, the Ten Commandments that God spoke from the mountain. That accomplished the 50 days from Passover to Pentecost, what's known in Hebrew as Shavuot. That was the first one. No Zitzit at the time, no Kippahs at the time. They accomplished Passover by the blood of the Lamb. The thing that we're recognizing as we have our Passover Seder today. After they're there, you'll remember, they made a golden calf. They had to stay there a whole year and learn all the things that God told them. Build a tabernacle, get it up, get it set, get it ready. And they practiced one Passover during that time. At the end of that year, the beginning of the second year, Numbers chapter 9, by the way, if you want a reference to read that, they had Passover in the wilderness at Mount Sinai. Then they leave there on the 20th day of the second month. They go to Kadesh Barnea and refuse to go into the promised land. Remember? So then God sends them back into the wilderness to spend another 39 years, a 40-year total, in the wilderness before they go in. The book of Deuteronomy is written to the children of Israel and given by Moses right before they go into the land. As a matter of fact, there's only a few days until Moses dies and the children of Israel spend that time of mourning, and then they go into the land. What's the first thing they done when they went into the land? Passover. They prepared themselves and they did and kept Passover. Very important that you understand this. Now, the instruction that Moses is going to give here is so they'll make sure that they continue to do what God says. And I'm having to kind of concentrate this, starting in verse 28. He says, "Be careful to listen to all these words which I command you, so that it may be well with you and your sons after you forever. For you will be doing what is good and right in the sight of the Lord your God." Yahweh, your Elohim. Does it say in James chapter 4, verse 17, "To him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it's sin"? The New American Standard Version I read to you was, "If you know to do right and do not do it, then to you that is sin." That's what he says, isn't it? I'm just telling you the Bible. So in verse 28 again, he says, "Be careful to listen to all these words which I command you, so that it may be well with you and your sons after you forever, for you will be doing what is good and right in the sight of the Lord your God." We want to do what's right. Verse 29. "When the Lord your God cuts off before you the nations which you are going to dispossess, and dispossess them and dwell in their land, beware that you are not ensnared to follow them after they are destroyed before you, and that you do not inquire after their gods, saying, 'How do these nations serve their gods, that I also may do likewise?'" God said, "I want you to be careful now. You got to be real careful about this, because this place you're going into, even though they have some background, they come out of Egypt and they would have worshipped a fertility goddess by the name of Isis. How many of you ever heard of Isis? They would have worshipped Isis, and they had a general idea of this fertility goddess, this many-breasted fertility goddess. But now the Canaanites, the Phoenicians and the Canaanites, they got this thing down to an art, to a science. She's called Ashtaroth. Okay, this fertility goddess is called Ashtaroth in Hebrew and Canaanite. And so that's what they called her there. And God knows that these people are experts on worshiping these gods. He said, "Now you're going to go in there and you're going to see how they worship their gods. And you may get it in your minds, you know, well, can I do it this way? Can I worship God this way?" God's already instructed them. There's no cutting corners. This is not a suggestion. He said, "You're to worship me, you're to keep the Passover." So in verse 31, look very carefully. you shall not behave thus toward the Lord your God. Now, I like King James really better there, because King James actually says there, you shall not worship me the way they worship these gods. In the same way that they worship these gods. So look at verse 31 again. You shall not behave thus toward the Lord your God, for every abominable act which the Lord hates, they have done for their gods. For they even burned their sons and daughters in the fire to their gods. Well, that don't sound good, does it? That kind of a practice don't sound good. It's so important that in verse 32, he says, whatever I command you, you shall be careful to do. And you shall not add to, nor take away from it. Have you ever heard that warning before? It's serious. See, it's so serious that God repeats it over and over and over. Well, why does he do that? I can show you at least three different places in Scripture where he says, you shall not add to, and you shall not take away. Now, according to God, this is not my law, it's not my opinion, but according to God, the only way that you can establish truth is to have two or three witnesses. This is a witness, that you shall not add to, you shall not take away. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that, right? Jolene, we'll come right back. Would you go with me to Revelation chapter 22? Let's see if there's anything said in the New Covenant about that, what we call the Brit Hadashah. In Revelation chapter 22 and verse 18, it's the last chapter of the book, he says, I testify to everyone who hears the words of the prophecy of this book. If anyone adds to them, God will add to him the plagues which are written in the book. Is there some serious plagues in this book? There is, aren't there? It's serious, isn't it? If anyone adds to them, God will add to him the plagues which are written in this book. And if anyone takes away from the words of this book of this prophecy, God will take away his part from the tree of life and from the holy city which are written in this book. The teaching and understanding of Passover is that important. Now, I know what people say. You can't throw an excuse at me that I've not dealt with before. But I do it out of my heart for the resurrection. I want to use somebody for an example. I need a couple. Les, you and Coley, come up here just a second. They're fairly newlyweds. I'm just going to tell everybody about this. You can come up here where everybody can see you and turn around. And I'm going to use one of my old buddy Jim Staley's illustrations. I've used this similar illustration to this, but I kind of like this one. It works real good. Let's say Les used to have this girlfriend that he was just crazy about. This is long before this married, and he dated her for years and years and years, and she had this 1969 red Mustang muscle car. Nice car. And Les went on hundreds of dates and had a wonderful time with his old girlfriend, but he met, Corrine. Well, ain't that crazy? You get old, you do that. He met Corrine, he fell in love with her, and they got married. Okay? The old girlfriend's not in the picture. On his first year anniversary, Les goes out and buys a 1969 red Mustang for her anniversary gift. Now, she knows all about the old girlfriend. And see, the only reason that he hadn't come to his senses yet is because she's not slapped his brains out. Thank you. I said that to say this. See, just because we have the right reasoning behind that. Now, Les could be sincere. I mean, he could talk about all the good times that he had and that red car going to place, you know, and having good times with the old girlfriend. And you know, he might have thought that she would really appreciate that. But she didn't. Would she? She wouldn't appreciate that. And so why would God, if we add to and take away from the plain instruction that he's given us on how to how to celebrate the death, burial, and resurrection of his dear son, how could he be happy with an alternative that he describes as being something horribly wrong? You see where I'm coming from? I hope you don't get mad at me and never speak to me again. I'm doing this because I love you. I really am. I think that we need to understand this. God said he has a way here in Deuteronomy in chapter 12. In verse 28, he said, I've got a way, and I want you to be careful to follow that way. Now, I don't care where you go into this land and what kind of other people you meet and, you know, how they worship their gods. I don't want you to worship me that way, because that way is wrong. Now, in order to get you to understand Passover on whether or not that's what you're going to do, you've got to make up your mind. Am I going to worship God the way that pleases him or the way that pleases me? That's a simple question, isn't it? See, because worship is not about pleasing you. Worship is about pleasing God. Now, if Les had been smart, he would have tried to please Corrine with something that pleases her, not with something that pleased his old girlfriend. Is that an illustration that makes sense? So he's going to do this thing because this religion, even though everybody there, just like the people in the lottery, everybody there thought it was right, all these Canaanites and all these Phoenicians there thought it was right because they've been practicing this for 1,000 years. As a matter of fact, it goes all the way back to Nimrod. It's a form of sun worship. Now, when we say that, a lot of times people today, they don't understand that when we talk about sun worship, we're not actually talking about people that, you know, go out and bow down and worship the sun, that sphere of gas that's up there now. That's not what it's about. Sun god worship was people worshiping a man who had become the god of the sun. That's what Nimrod, and the name they gave him was Baal. In the church, you may have heard it pronounced as Baal. It's Baal worship or Baal worship. Now, Nimrod died, you know. I won't go into all the details. That's a fascinating story. Nimrod dies, and he's supposed to have ascended to heaven and became the god of the sun. He was Baal. The Hebrew word Baal is the Strong's word, 1167, if I'm not mistaken. It's the Strong's. You can look this up for yourself. The word Baal means master or husband or owner. Now, Baal can be your husband, your owner, your ruler, whatever you want to look at. That's Baal worship. So he dies. Now, he was thought to be, according to the scriptures, this great hunter. But he was one of the mightiest leaders who has ever lived on planet Earth. He was the first world ruler. You remember he built the Tower of Babel? And it got so bad, God had to come down and confuse their own language. See, what he was actually trying to do was replace God. See, they were building the tower not so that they just have this big name. They was building the tower because, you know, just a few years before that, there had been a flood. And in those people's thinking, and Nimrod's thinking, well, we'll just build a tower, reach up to heaven, and say, now, God, now you can't get us. You can't drown us now. He's trying to defy God. He had a wife. You don't see this in Scripture. You have to go to historical books and read. This is, I mean, there's places you can go. You can read the book of Jasher that the Scriptures tell us to read. You can find out that her name is Semiramis. And Semiramis, this woman that was a widow now, years later, becomes pregnant. She don't have a husband, but she's pregnant. Now, she's got to come up with some reason, because I don't know but one way that happens except an immaculate conception, right? And so she says that she was impregnated by one of the rays of the sun, her husband, who had become the sun god. She was impregnated by one of the rays of the sun. You say, well, nobody would believe a story like that. You believe in the Easter Bunny, don't you? Tell me you won't believe stuff like that. It happens. The people believe that. Now, when that son was born, she named him Tammuz. Now, the people, because of this immaculate conception, gave her the name or the title Queen of Heaven. And, you know, life goes on. Here's Tammuz, and he becomes a mighty hunter. And the world thinks that he's this great leader. He's the reincarnation of his father. And, oh, you know, the world's going to go back just like it was under this one great ruler, and everything's just going to be great. And the trouble is, he's out hunting one day, and he's killed by a wild boar. Oh, the people are all to pieces. Their God has died. He's been killed by a wild boar. So the people of that day declares, and his mother declares, that there will be 40 days of mourning for Tammuz. And at the end of that 40 days, in order to get revenge, they will kill a wild boar and eat ham on the first Sunday after the vernal equinox. That was the day of his death. Are we getting an idea where these holidays come from and why God don't like them? See, God don't like counterfeits. When you try to counterfeit the death, burial, and resurrection, you're trying to confuse people and damn their souls. You're trying to confuse people and lead them astray to what God says. People that want to please God are careful to do it the way God says. And it doesn't matter, you know, what other people are saying, what they're doing. You make a choice to go ahead and do what God says and do it that way. Okay, he dies. Years later, she gets old, she dies. But as it would be in Babylonian legend, she's carried off to heaven, but she's sent back to earth by the gods. And she's in an egg. And the egg falls into the Euphrates River. And I'm just telling you history, folks. You read this stuff yourself. I'm not making none of this up, okay? She falls back into the Euphrates River. The egg bursts open, and the first thing she sees is a bird, and she changes it into an egg-laying rabbit. It becomes a religion. To the point, you know, these people believe in fertility. A rabbit is the most fertile thing that they could imagine. An egg was the most, you know, that represented life. And, you know, this is what was in their heart and what was in their mind. They just knew that that had to be right. And this legend became the religion. There was a whole group of priests, even before she died, that were her priests that carried on this religion. And after her death, this is what they would do. Now, this is something that some of you are not going to like to hear, and I didn't like to hear it the first time that I ever read it and went to actual places where I could find the facts and history books and found out that this is so. The priest would actually, they had an altar to the sun, to Baal. And on this altar, every year on the first Sunday after the vernal equinox, the first day of the week after the vernal equinox, which is in spring, they would take virgins and impregnate them on the altar of Baal. That's what they done. Now, next year, those virgins would have children at the same time next year on this first Sunday after the vernal equinox. They would have children that were 3 months old. They would take those three-month-old children after the sunrise service because they impregnated them at sunrise. After the children were 3 months old, after this ceremony went again the next year, they would take those three-month-old babies, they would sacrifice them, they would cut their throat on the altar of Baal, and they would take eggs and dye their eggs red in the blood of those babies. Now, these are historical facts. There's plenty of places you can check up on me. Make sure that I'm telling you the truth. We in America like pastel-colored eggs, don't we? That's pretty much, you know, we like the light blues and greens, and they're all pretty, and, you know, you got a rabbit carrying them around a basket and all that, you know, just having just great fun. And but did you know that worldwide, the favorite color, and as a matter of fact, in the Greek Orthodox Church, if you're a member of the Greek Orthodox Church, you cannot have eggs except dyed red Easter eggs. Okay? As a matter of fact, the most popular color of eggs for Easter in the world is red. I wonder why. Even our capital in the United States, in Washington, D.C., the national Easter egg is a ruby red glass Easter egg. If you don't believe me, check up on it. They don't try to hide it. They don't try to hide that that's what it is. The facts are there. You see, there's people in the world who says, well, I don't do it for that reason. Why do you do it? Well, it's a good way of celebrating the resurrection. God's got a better way. He said, my way is so good, it's so perfect, it teaches about the death, burial, and resurrection. Now, just to give you a little bit of an idea, if you want to look this up, and let me give you the... If you want to read about this, here's a source, and I'll give it to you after the service if you want to. It's called the New Question Box, okay? See, even a quick look at what the Catholic historians are saying about the subject is revealing. This is what they say. The reasons for celebrating our major feast, when we do, are many and varied. In general, however, it is true that many of them have at least an indirect connection with the pre-Christian pagan feast celebrated about the same time of year. Feasts centering around the harvest and rebirth of the sun at the winter solstice. Now on the Gregorian calendar is December 21st, but if you was looking on a Julian calendar, that's December 25th. The renewal of nature in spring and so on. Now this quote was found in the New Question Box. And it's written by Catholic Life for the 90s, copyrighted in 1988 by John Dietzen. He's got a whole bunch of letters after his name because he's real smart, you know. And the ISB number for this book is ISBN 0-940518-01-5. It's in a paperback. It's paperback. It's published by Guildhall Publishers in Peoria, Illinois. And it's found on page 554. The Catholics admit that the holidays that we celebrate in Christendom today are of pagan origin. And God said in Deuteronomy chapter 12, they're of pagan origin. You be careful to don't get caught up in the do of those things. You say, well, I've done that. That's what I was taught all my life. Well, Jeremiah 16:19 says, in the last days, he's talking prophetically there, he says, in the last days the Gentiles will come from the ends of the earth, saying, surely we've inherited lies, vanity, and things wherein there's no profit. Folks, it's happening. You see, even if I take a dictionary, now, if I were to read to you from the Oxford Dictionary, and I got this wrote down here so I can make sure to get it right. The Oxford Dictionary defines Easter as the name of a many-breasted fertility goddess. I have in my hand a new Webster's Dictionary, New World Dictionary, College Dictionary. It's the same thing you got around your house. I'll open it to the word Easter. I'll give you the definition right here. It says, Easter, original name of pagan vernal festival, almost coincident with the date of Passover festival of the church. It's in the dictionary. It's in encyclopedias. If you go back now, encyclopedias change. If you get a new modern day version, it may have some other thing. Go back to the 40s. Read an encyclopedia from there. I guarantee you it'll tell you everything that I've been telling you here today. Just people don't pay any attention. Because we've been doing it for 1,700 years. We need to understand that God takes this thing really, really serious. And he says he hates these things. And yet we have developed them. You say, well, how in the world did we come to that? Well, for the first 150 years after Yeshua died, there was no church whatsoever that celebrated Easter. None. Now, in the second century, after the death of the apostles, there were missionaries still going out from the church who went up into northern Rome and places like that. And these people were so paganized. And things had gotten so bad, if you'll remember in 70 A.D., the temple was destroyed. And the hatred for the Jews grew. And everybody says these are Jewish feasts, right? Except in Leviticus chapter 23, God says these are the feasts of the Lord. They're not feasts of the Jews. They're feasts of the Lord, Yahweh. But these missionaries that went up there, and it was such a dangerous thing, they began to say, well, you know, we're going to get killed. And by the way, they were under horrible persecution. And the ones that become Christians, they become under horrible persecution because they were keeping these feast days. Now, they already celebrated this goddess. Now, if you were Greek, you would call her Astarte. If you were in Egypt, you'd call her Isis. Back in the land, in Hebrew, you'd call her Ashtaroth. But if you were in Babylon, you'd call her Ishtar. Now, if you're Anglo-Saxon, you would Anglicize that and you would call her Easter. That's where the name came from. I'm not changing this. This is what happened. That's the etymology of the word. Get you an etymological dictionary. You can trace it just like I do. It's not hard. That's where the name came from. It's Easter. Now, those people already worshiped this goddess. You know, they had Easter eggs then. They believed in egg-laying rabbits, Easter bunnies. And that was fine. The government, you know, condoned that. And so the missionary said, well, since this is, coming pretty much close to the same time, you know, you just become Christians and you tell them that you're doing these spring feasts and actually you can sneak around and be doing Passover. You can do both and fool them. There's one problem with that. And I'm not anti-missionary, but they changed from discipling people like Yeshua taught the disciples to do and disciple other people to do what God said and began to worry more about numbers than people's lives. And so the tradition caught on. By the time we get to 325 A.D., the Council of Nicaea, to a man by the name of Constantine, you know, they're already talking about, well, now some of these Christians in Mesopotamia. And see, they're hating the Jews now because in 165 A.D., 70 A.D. was the destruction of the temple, but in 165 A.D., there was still a remnant of Jews thinking they're Maccabees, I guess, rose up and tried to overthrow the Roman government. And the Roman government just sick and tired of these aggravating, pesky Jews by now. And if you remember that the Christian church, the early church, is only a sect at that time of Judaism. There's many sects of Judaism, just like there's denominations. But the church was one of those sects. And they kept all the feasts. That's why in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 7, Paul says, since Jesus is our Passover, let us keep the feast. They kept the feast. But they got away from that because the persecution was just horrible, and they wanted the persecution to stop. And so eventually, you know, they finally got to the place to where, let me find you this, they had the Council of Nicaea. Council of Nicaea says this. They come up with the Constantine Creed. Constantine, who supposedly is this great Christian who accepted Jesus and got baptized and stopped all the persecution, was not really who people think he was. As a matter of fact, when he was baptized, he said he believed. He joined the so-called church. He's the first pope, not Peter. Peter was not the first pope. Pope means Pontius Maximus. Peter never claimed to be that, never was that. It didn't start till 325 A.D. under Constantine, a Roman emperor who pretended to worship Christianity but was a secret worshiper of Mithra. That's the Roman word of saying Ashtaroth and Baal to the day he died. Now, he was baptized, but he wouldn't let him baptize his sword because he said he's not going to give that up. But at the Council of Nicaea, and since he's become this world ruler at the time, he demands that certain things take place. From now on, the resurrection that they're going to celebrate Jesus was going to be on the first Sunday after vernal equinox. Never mind what the scriptures say. Never mind what the Bible tells us to do. It's just going to be on that Sunday. As a matter of fact, Constantine says, if you're going to be a Christian, this is what you've got to do. You will say, I renounce all customs. This is the Constantine Creed. I renounce all customs, rites, legalism, unleavened breads and sacrifices of lambs of the Hebrews and all other feasts of the Hebrews, sacrifices, prayers, aspirations, purifications, sanctifications and propitiations and fasts and new moons and Sabbaths and superstitions. And hymns and chants and observances and synagogues, absolutely everything Jewish. See, they'd already defined what was God's feast as something Jewish and bad. There's people today who find out that you do Passover will think you're bad because you're doing something Jewish. That's what they think this is. It's not. He goes on to say, every law, right, and custom, and afterwards, I shall wish to be, if I wish to deny and return to Jewish superstitions, or shall be found eating with Jews, or fasting, feasting with them, or secretly conversing and condemning the Christian religion instead of openly confuting them and condemning their vain faith, then let the trembling of the of Cain and the leprosy of Gehazi cleave to me, as well as the legal punishment to which I acknowledge myself liable, and may I be anathema in the world to come, and may my soul be set down with Satan and the devils. You say, Gary, you're making that up. This is a Roman Catholic book. Here's the title. Stefano Asamamin Acta Sanctorium Martyrum Ortilium et Occidentalium. It's volume 1, Rome, 1748, and it's on page 105. You can go check that out, read it for yourself. I'm not making this up. He goes on to say, furthermore, any follower of the Jewish Messiah, Yeshua HaMashiach, Jesus Christ, who wished to join this holy community was compelled to adopt a different set of rules and customs. Subsequently, special creeds were drafted to which Christians would have to swear, such as, I accept all customs, rites, legalisms, and feasts of Rome, sacrifices, prayers, purifications with water, sanctification by Pontius Maximus, high priest of Rome, propitiations and feasts and new Sabbaths, Solii, the day of the sun, all new chants and observances, and all the food and drink of the Romans. In other words, I absolutely accept everything Roman, every new law, right, and custom of Rome, and the new Roman religion. Except there's nothing new about any of this. It went back thousands of years. Oh, they changed the name. It's not Baal worship anymore. It's Mithra worship. But it's still the God of the sun. It's not changed one bit. See, additionally, in approximately 365 A.D., the Council of Laodicea wrote in one of their canons, Christians must not Judaize by resting on Sabbath, but must work on that day, rather honoring the Lord's day. The Lord's day? I thought, didn't Yeshua say, I'm the Lord of the Sabbath? Well, the Lord's day is a term to represent the Lord Baal. It's the first day of the week, not the seventh. Goes on to say, but if any shall be found to be Judaizers, let them be anathema against or from Messiah. Now, Protestants are included as they still observe the holidays and Sabbath of Rome, as in, are you going to church on the Lord's Day? And they don't even realize it. How many of you ever, at a party or whatever, or graduation or something, you said, hip, hip, hooray? You just joined right in with that, and you didn't know what it was, but you said, hip, hip, hooray, because you're thinking in your mind that's this great celebration because somebody's went through college and now they've graduated, and we want to cheer them on. Guess where the saying come from? In 70 A.D., when Titus destroyed the temple and destroyed millions of God's people, the Jews and Christians alike, when they killed over 2 million in that city at that time, Titus, the Roman ruler, would have parties for his victory. And in Latin, and I can't remember how to say the Latin words, but they, when translated, are hip, hip, hooray. So when Titus would go around and have his party and brag about killing all these believers and destroying the temple of God, and everybody would take their drink and hold it up and say, hip, hip, hooray. So don't think just because you think you know something that sometimes we actually don't. We're actually joining in something that, gosh, that should never come out of my mouth. That's the origins of that. That's where that come from. As a matter of fact, about 165 years before Yeshua, or about 190 years really, before Yeshua was even born, there was a type of the Antichrist come to earth. His name was Antiochus Epiphanes. You remember that's why we do Hanukkah? He brought a pig and slaughtered it on the altar of God and desecrated it. He set up a statue of Zeus there. Well, he passed some laws too. He said, thou shalt profane the Sabbath. Thou shalt change the set times or festivals. You shall change the feast days. Change them to something else. You shall set up idols. You shall eat unclean animals. You shall not circumcise, and you shall forget the Torah. 3 years and 2 months later, the temple was regained by Judas Maccabeus and the altar rededicated. 3 years and 6 months of great tribulation after the altar is shut down, Yeshua will be back and he will set that altar back up again. The Passover lamb that's coming. Now I want to close this right quickly. And I've got a lot more to say to you. And hope I've not offended you. I'm just giving you the facts. Because I want to read Deuteronomy chapter 12 verse 28 again. Be careful to listen to all these words which I command you, so that it will be well with you and with your sons after you, for you will be doing what is good and right in the sight of the Lord your God. See, with my health, I don't know if I'm going to be here another year. I don't know if we'll ever have another opportunity. I think that we're living so close in the end days that we may not have another opportunity to ever get together at a Passover like this and teach on how it's supposed to be done. I don't know that. But I want to do what's right while I can. I may not be around next year. Something horrible may happen next year. But I want to do what's right. Now, if I do what's right, according to this verse here, he's actually saying what he says somewhere else. At the judgment, God will look at me if I'm doing what's right, and he'll say, "Enter in, thou good and faithful servant." Is that right? Is that what Yeshua said he'd say? "Enter in, thou good and faithful servant." But I know that in Matthew chapter 7 in verse 21, he says to his disciples there and to everybody that would listen even to today, "Everyone that says to me, Lord, Lord, our master, our husband, shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. But he that does the will of my Father which is in heaven." Now many will say in that day, "Lord, have we not prophesied in your name?" I'm not saying they're not religious. "Lord, have we not cast out devils in your name? Have we not done many wonderful works in your name?" And he'll say, "Depart from me, ye that work iniquity." And that means ye that were without the Torah, the teaching and instruction of God. You that were unwilling to follow it. I don't care if you say you're following your heart or whatever. You wasn't willing to do what he said. They'll say, "Lord, we've done all these things." And he'll say, "Depart from me, for I never knew you." Now these are believers. He's not telling them to go to hell. Okay? He's not telling them that's where they're going to be cast. That's not what that scripture is about. It's at the judgment seat of Messiah for believers. And he stopped and think about this. If I'm there, and he says, "Gary, enter in, thou good and faithful servant." And I enter in. And then you come up and he says, "Depart from me, for you didn't keep my Torah." The Bible says there's going to be weeping and gnashing of teeth. I can imagine that to be true, wouldn't you? I can imagine in my heart the anguish that a person must, "Oh my God, what have I done? Why didn't I just do it the way God?" Well, it was in my heart. Your heart was desperately wicked and deceitful above all things. And you can't even know it. Only God can know it. But we can know his word. You know, I look forward to the day to hear that, don't you? And I hope everybody in the sound of my voice hears the Lord say, "Enter in, thou good and faithful servant." But if he does, and some of your friends, some of your family don't understand this, and they just go right on with tradition, which traditions have made the word of God of none effect today, just like it did in Yeshua's day, while they're weeping and gnashing their teeth, I've always imagined him looking at me and saying, "Gary, you knew the truth. Why didn't you tell me? But I was afraid to. You'd get mad at me. You didn't love me. If you love me as you love yourself, you would have told me." See, Passover is God's way of telling you. It's God's way of telling you about the death of his son, the burial of his son, the resurrection of his son. And verse 29 of this chapter says, "When the Lord your God cuts off before you the nations which you're going to dispossess and dispossess them and dwell in their land, beware that you're not ensnared to follow them." Because you just get tricked into it. You say, well, people would never fall into that. Not the children of Israel that went through the wilderness, not the ones that went through all of this. They'd never get caught up in that. Listen to what happens in Judges just a few years later. right after Joshua dies. Chapter 2, verse 11. Then the sons of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served Baals, and they forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt, and followed other gods from among the gods of the peoples who were around them, and bowed themselves down to them, and thus provoked the Lord to anger. So they forsook the Lord and served Baal and Ashtaroth. Isn't that kind of scary? The anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he gave them into the hands of the plunderers who plundered them. And he sold them into the hand of their enemies around them, and so that they could no longer stand before their enemies. And whenever they went, the hand of the Lord was against them for evil. And the Lord had spoken, and as the Lord had sworn to them, so they were severely distressed. Judges chapter 2, starting in verse 11 through verse 15. Well, God got angry because they was worshiping Baal and Ashtaroth. He punished them. They repented. They quit doing it. They went back to worshiping God just like he said. But when you get over to chapter 10 and verse 6, they're right back to doing it again. They're worshiping Baal and Ashtaroth all over again. Just the next generation. Should we be careful about what we're actually doing for the Lord? Am I doing what pleases him? Well, you know, if I want to please my husband, if my wife wants to please me, she does what I want, right? If she's trying to please me. If as a husband, I want to please my wife, I do as she wants. Every one of you men will understand this. If my wife wants to talk about a problem she has, my idea is just give her the answer. It's done, you know. It's fixed right then. They're not pleased with that, though, are the fellas? They don't want you to fix their problems. They want you to listen to them. Is that not correct? They simply want you to listen to them. That's what pleases them. I'd rather fix the problem, but I can't do it. If I fix the problem, they just get mad. It don't please them. God says in Deuteronomy 12:29, when the Lord your God cuts off before you the nations which you're going to dispossess and dispossesses them to dwell in their land, beware that you are not ensnared to follow after them and are destroyed before you, and that you may not inquire after their gods, saying, how do these nations serve their gods, that I also may do likewise? You shall not behave thus toward the Lord your God. God says, I don't want it. I don't want you to, take that kind of worship and put my name on it and say that you're worshiping me. You might think you are, but God said, that won't please me. Because some of the things they do, and some of the things I've told you about these pagan religions are abominable, aren't they? They worship fertility type things. As a matter of fact, I got to do this. Go with me to Ezekiel chapter number 8. Ezekiel, the 8th chapter. Now we're talking about God's people. The people that followed God through the instruction of the Passover lamb. Now you might be here saying, well, we're Gentiles and we don't have to do those things. But Isaiah chapter 56, God said, don't you even say that. There's one law for the native born and one for the alien. There's not two sets of laws. You will not take this Bible and show me where God says for us to do Easter. You will not show me that. Will not happen. But in chapter 8, God talking to Ezekiel here, and this is one of the greatest visions I believe you'll ever see. Let me start in verse 5. Then he said to me, son of man, raise your eyes now toward the north. And so I raised my eyes toward the north, and behold, the north of the altar gate was the idol of jealousy at the entrance. What in the world is that? Well, it's Baal worship. Remember, it's all about fertility stuff. God said, Ezekiel, I want to show you. My people, you know, that I told not to ever do this, and for them to be careful not to ever get caught up in the way that they worship these gods, have took this idol and put it in front of my temple. Right to the north of it. Well, what was that? It was a phallic symbol. A male phallic symbol. popular in Roman Catholic churches all over Europe in the early time of the Roman Catholic Church. They had these in front of the churches, sitting over to the side. They had these phallic symbols to worship the fertility, the beam of the sun, I'm just a simple country boy. I always wondered, you see these pictures of Yeshua and his disciples, and they've got these supposed halos and look like sunbeams coming off of them. And then when I read my Bible, I see where, that everybody's trying to figure out whether this is really the Messiah or not. Is there anything special about this guy or not? You show me some guys with halos around their head, with sunbeams coming out, and I'm going to think there's something special about them. Wouldn't you? That didn't happen. This fertility symbol. God said, Ezekiel, can you believe what they're doing after I told them not to? Well, in Europe, after the cities began to get so crowded and the great Roman cathedrals got so packed in, they didn't have any room then to put them beside the churches, the cathedrals. They put them on top. And that's what you call a steeple in your Protestant church today. You say, well, it don't look like it. That's what it symbolizes. Just like the Easter egg symbolizes the egg dyed red and the blood of babies that worshiped Easter. God speaks about it in Ezekiel chapter 8. He said, can you believe what they're doing? Go just a little bit farther with me. Verse 7. Then he brought me to the entrance of the court, and when I looked, and behold, a hole in the wall, and he said to me, Son of man, now dig through the wall. And so I dug through the wall, and behold, an entrance. And he said to me, go in and see the wicked abominations that they're committing here. And so I entered and looked, and behold, every form of creeping thing and beast and detestable things with all the idols of the house of Israel were carved on the wall all around. Standing in front of them were 70 elders of the house of Israel. What? These are God's people. With Jazaniah, the son of Shaphan, standing among them, each man with his censer in his hand, and the fragrance of the cloud of incense rising. Now we know the Torah. There's one man supposed to have a censer to offer incense on the altar of incense. That was the high priest, right? What's every one of them doing with censers? They've changed the instructions of God to do it the way they want to. Verse 12 says, then he said to me, Son of man, do you see what the elders of the house of Israel are committed in the dark, each man in the room of his carved images? For they say, the Lord does not see us, the Lord has forsaken the land. And he said to me, yet you will see greater abominations which are they are committing. What? Worse? Verse 14. Then he brought me to the entrance of the gate of the Lord's house, which was toward the north, and behold, women were sitting there weeping for Tammuz. What did I just tell you about a while ago? Oh, we don't call it weeping for Tammuz. We call it the 40 days of Lent. You know where you do that bologna sandwiches or something for that 40 days and punish yourself? He said to me, and this is verse 15, he said to me, do you see this, Son of man? Yet you will see greater abominations than these. Then he brought me into the inner court of the Lord's house, and behold, to the entrance of the temple of the Lord, behold, the porch and the altar. There were about 25 men with their backs to the temple of the Lord and their faces toward the east, and they were prostrating themselves eastward toward the sun. True story. Got a son here that went to a wedding a few years back. He was in a Methodist church. He could have been in any other church. Wouldn't have mattered, but this one just happened to be in a Methodist church, and it was right around Easter time. And they were going to celebrate Easter very soon, but they were having the wedding in this church. And they had this great banner that must have cost hundreds of dollars to make and put up there. And they're celebrating Easter. And they have a man, his wife, and children. And they're on their knees praying to the sun. Because that's the way they worship Easter. Yeshua was not the God of the sun. He was the Son of God. He's the God of the whole universe. God has the right to ask me to worship Him in a certain way. And then in turn, I have a responsibility to worship Him that way. Now I have to understand that. Oh yeah, I done the same thing that everybody else done. And I kept reading Scripture and I kept thinking, there's something wrong here. A sunrise service that these priests of God... were mimicking what the priest of Saremesis did when they impregnated those virgin girls on the altar of Baal. They were mimicking dying Easter eggs in the blood of sacrificed babies. Are we going to really make a choice? One day we'll run out of time. There won't be any time to make a choice. And you say, well, I didn't understand it. God says, you can't understand it. I've told it to you thousands of years ago. I've showed it to you. I've illustrated it over and over and over and over again. Folks, let me tell you something. There has been believers, even though a very few of them, ever since Yeshua died, that have been keeping the Passover and have never succumbed to this idea of the false worship of God. I hope you make a choice according to the Word of God. And I hope you don't get mad at me. I hope you don't get mad at God. This is what God said. See, my real heart's desire is to tell you the truth and show you how to really celebrate and show your friends and family how to really celebrate the death, burial, and resurrection of Yeshua. It's done with the Passover Seder that we're going to do here in just a minute. Lots of other things I'd like to tell you, just don't have time. But we're going to take just a few minutes to have just a short break. I know some needs to go to the bathroom or whatever. We'll take a short break and we'll get right back to our Seder service. And this will be a lot more blessing than my teaching, all right?